Welcome to Unframed, the podcast which hosts talks and conversations about South African art and artists. I am your host, Anthea Fakoy. Welcome to episode 23 of Unframed. This is the first episode in a series on Unframed called Artists in Isolation, which profiles South African artists during the lockdown period of the COVID-19 pandemic. We are living through unprecedented times, where we are needing to find new ways of connecting with each other and the broader art community, of being inspired and of creating more platforms for artists. On today's show, I chat with Io McCundell about her artistic practice. Io McCundell is an interdisciplinary artist based in Johannesburg. Working primarily with drawing and installation, her practice is concerned with the process of entropy, the binary between nature and artifice, living and dying, urban ecology and architecture, and order and chaos. McCundell holds a BA Fine Art at Michaelis School of Fine Arts in Cape Town and is currently a master's candidate at the Wit School of Arts. McCundell has exhibited in group exhibitions both locally and internationally and had two solo exhibitions in Johannesburg. Her work is part of several private and corporate collections. Please enjoy listening to my conversation with McCundell. Hi, McCundell. Welcome to this episode of Unframed.
Hi, Anthea. Thank you so much.
Io McCundell is a Johannesburg-based artist. I'm going to get her to introduce herself properly in a moment. But she's also a very close friend, and she's been a huge advocate of the podcast, of me starting it, and also very kindly designed the beautiful Unframed logo. I'm very happy to have you as my first guest artist during what I'm calling an Artists in Isolation series. This comes at a very strange time in our lives, completely unprecedented, something that I could never have imagined we would be living through, the COVID-19 pandemic. And we're all currently in a national lockdown, supposedly until the end of April. So I thought it would be a really good opportunity while we're all at home to connect virtually via Zoom to talk to artists about what they're up to during this time and how they're finding the self-isolation and how their practices are continuing or not. So for our listeners who do not know you, McCundell, who is Io McCundell?
Thank you, Anthea. So I am an artist based in Johannesburg, and I have been living here for over 6 years. And I've got a home studio, luckily. Yes, and I am a drawer and interdisciplinary artist that works in various different forms.
So before we begin talking about your work and your practice, I'd like to ask you to tell our listeners where they can see your work. I think it's important for people to be able to look at your work while we're chatting. So where online can they see your work?
So you can see my work on Instagram and on my website. So my website is iomcundell.com, and my Instagram handle is also iomcundell.
And I will include those in the show notes. So let's begin in this context, at this very moment. How are you doing? How has isolation been for you? I can imagine like the life of an artist and also being a new mom isn't too different. It's you're quite used to the self-isolation at this point of your life, maybe. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I think at this point I am quite used to it. I've spent a lot of time at home over the last 7 months. And as you said, due to the birth of my son, so I've been working from home for quite a while now. But also just, it's interesting how once you are restricted, suddenly you have the urge to leave your house. So I think since we've been in lockdown, for some reason it has mentally been a harder than before. And I think that's also just because previously I was able to go walk my dogs and, you know, run various errands that I needed to run. So you would have those breaks from being at home, whereas now you're constantly at home. So yeah, it has its ups and downs, but for the most part, it's been good. for now.
Yeah, we've got another 3 weeks still. Yeah. Let's talk in 3 weeks again. So about being a mother, like, how are you finding the balance between kind of your motherly duties and your artistic practice, and how are you managing to balance that?
Yeah, I think it is a tricky thing, or can be a tricky thing, simply because I think both roles demand a lot of you, being a mum and being an artist. And I certainly consider my art practice as a baby too. You know, it's like something that you birth and take care of equally as much as you should your child. So it's been tricky, but before I gave birth, I interviewed a lot of other artist mothers and asked them about how they managed to adapt to the role and their time. And they gave a lot of insightful skills and tools to implement, and just, you know, time management. And yeah, I think with that, I also rallied a support network around me as well of mother artists. So I often, if I'm struggling at times, would speak to somebody and kind of ask their advice on how to handle things. Yeah, so it is a juggling game, but there are ways, you know, it's obviously possible, because I think you just need to have the right intentions and dedication to your practice. So yeah, nighttime is my golden time when baby's asleep. When my son is asleep, then I have, you know, good, solid moment in time to work in the evenings. Whereas during the day, it's like broken up into like half an hour there, an hour here. Whereas nighttime is like a good like 5-6 hours. So yeah.
Yeah. Just tell me a little bit about your background and how you became an artist. I remember meeting you in 2013, 2014. I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it was at the end of your university degree that you did this project and called the Cube Gallery.
The Cube Gallery. Cube Root, yeah.
Cube Root. And you could talk a little bit more about that. And I met you in the parking lot of the Assemblage Studios, because Assemblage was one of your bases. So I remember that was the first time I met you. But just tell us a little bit about before then and up until now, what you've been up to.
So yes, after I studied fine arts, I took a bit of a break from the art world, and I worked a little bit in the design industry for a while. But then in about 2016, I returned to my art practice, and that's when I started working in seriousness on my work. And it was about then that I got a studio at Assemblage, and I think it was when I got a studio that I took it very seriously, and have been working ever since then, and yeah, going from opportunity to opportunity and exhibition to exhibition, and yeah, just trying to make it happen.
I see that when people get a studio, you know, the idea of getting a studio is often, for a lot of artists, like they get a studio and then they realize, okay, wait, no. But artists like you, it was an incentive to keep on going. You're like, okay, I have this rent to pay. Like,
yes.
I need to take this seriously. And I feel like it does become quite a strong motivation for artists to really push themselves. And also, I suppose being in an environment around other artists can be incredibly motivating and supportive.
Definitely. Interestingly, though, I think Assemblage was the only studio that I rented. Yeah, I mean, since I moved out of there, I've had a home studio wherever I've lived, quite fortunately, because I love to work at night in the early hours of the morning. You know, my golden time for me is, you know, around midnight and into the early hours of the morning. Like, that's when I'm my most active. And so having a home studio is really beneficial to that. So yeah, it's interesting that I've only really had one studio outside of my home. But having said that, I think now being a mother and having a child, I think that's definitely going to change in a way where, if I can, like, I would like to have a studio outside of the home, because then I can also time block very, you know, dedicatedly, like going to another space, to another studio to work, and then coming home, and then that's kind of, you know, I enter my mother role again, and then leave to go studio.
Yeah, it's important to create those distinctions, your overhead space.
Not that I think that they should be very exclusive to each other. I mean, I think, yeah, I shouldn't separate it too much either.
Why do you say, like, what about being a mother is it bringing to your practice, would you say?
I think the role of being a mother requires you to be very adaptive, spontaneous, but at the same time routined. Yeah, it just, like, activates a whole different side of you. Or at least for me, it's, like, activating a very different part of myself where I'm needing to rely on my own wisdom and intuition and, like, knowing when something's right or knowing when something's wrong, as well as doing a lot of research and knowing, like, okay, well, this is the right thing, or this is what I should be doing at this time. I mean, I take it very seriously. Like, I don't know. For me, I do a lot of reading on, like, a child's development, and I think, yeah, just applying that kind of rigorous doing in parenting, I also do in my practice.
That's really interesting.
And I think also just surrendering to, you know, there's also, you can't completely control a situation, and you also have to just surrender to it and lean into what your child needs or is communicating to you. And I think it's the same with, or I'm learning that with my practice too, where it's like, it is its own thing in itself, where you have to listen. So it's, I think it's also about listening, and I'm realizing that more and more on how to listen.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your artistic practice? So, you know, what is the content? What is the medium?
So, yeah, some of the themes that I work with are the idea of entropy, landscape, and the relationship between the artifice and nature. And also I'm interested in materialism or materiality, plantscapes. Yeah, so there's a lot of that I draw from. But those are the main themes that I work with. And then obviously our human condition and the human relationship to all of those things.
Yeah, and those kind of workings would manifest often in drawing and installation.
Drawing, installation and installation made from readily made objects and detritus that I would find around the city. You know, natural materials and like artificial materials, plastics and concrete and, so I kind of work with a whole range of different materials to then make these, what I call tactile drawings, in space. And then also these more traditional type of drawings on paper where they also, they abstract and they, you know, in my more traditional paper two-dimensional drawings, for me, those are abstracted landscapes, or mindscapes that I'm kind of working within, like creating these new hybrid environments.
I really love the term tactile drawing. I think it's a really kind of tactile word. Like, I can see, and I suppose because I know your work so well, like the way in which you use line and texture and like mark making in your kind of what you call traditional two-dimensional drawings is very, very much echoed in these kind of three-dimensional tactile drawings. Can you talk a little bit more about the relationship between the tactile drawings and the traditional drawings? And are the traditional drawings sketches for the tactile drawings, or are they quite separate?
Yeah, I mean, they're separate in the sense that they are their own kind of complete things in themselves. So the traditional paper drawings, I'll just call them the 2D paper drawings, those are, they're not sketches for the tactile drawings necessarily, not in any kind of formal way. But I guess in a sense, I'm always working on one or the other. But the tactile drawings, if I'm doing an installation, then I do try to not mimic, but emulate the form and, as you say, like mark making and line with the materials that I'm using in the installation. I mean, that definitely was a very conscious decision earlier in my earlier installations. I think I'm starting to move away from that now with my installations, where my kind of decision making in what materials to use is changing. Rather not to emulate the paper drawings, but to speak another language, like develop its own language to speak about other things. Yeah, but I think definitely the tactile drawings, when you walk in them, when you get to experience them spatially, I do want to kind of create the sense that you are walking inside one of the drawings, one of my two-dimensional drawings.
You quite successfully did that with your augmented reality piece.
Yes,
you really were walking through a drawing, and it did definitely give the feeling that you were walking through one of your installations.
Yeah. I was about to say that when that's almost like the next step. The next step was to take that into a virtual reality space where, you know, there's a physical tactile drawing that you get to experience. But then once you go into this digital virtual space, you then like further immersed into that reality.
You spoke about like your earlier installations, or it makes me think of your nests that you used to create, and you know, they were almost like self-contained objects rather than what you're doing now, which is very immersive and experiential, and you play with space in entire rooms and entire environments.
Yeah.
It's almost like no beginning and no end, where, you know, there's no, it's not like a self-contained object.
Yeah, I think my earlier works were very, they were sculptures. They were sculptural, and I would consider those sculptures, where they were these like self-contained objects. They were like micro tactile drawings, in a way.
Yeah.
So that these contained micro tactile drawings with and then as I kind of developed, I expanded them further afield into the entire space, and I started working with the architecture of a space and with the kind of confines of a room and the corner, and I started to become interesting with the actual architecture as a platform to kind of converse with that as the substrate to work against. So that's what started to happen then, is that the actual room became very important to how you experience the space. And I mean, those opportunities of using an entire room don't always come my way. I mean, I would love to work more in that way. I mean, I'd love entire buildings to work within. And I think, if I may speak to you about the villa show that Jonathan Freemantle curated, that was probably my most favorite opportunity to make a tactile drawing, where also because the whole space spoke to everything that I'm interested in, where it was this abandoned and dilapidated mansion in Hyde Park that he was working in. He had a studio there for a while, and just before it was being demolished, he invited a few artists to work in there and to have this show. It was so incredibly exciting for me, because it was exactly what the kind of a space that I would want to work in. So I took up a room in the house and got to really play and get messy in it.
Yeah.
It was great.
When you speak about like the tactile quality of the drawings, I think it like absorbs all your senses. So a lot of the time you have these, like this mobility in your installations. So there's movement, there's wind, there's smell, there's, you know, you really just ignite all the senses in those installations.
Well, I hope, yeah, I'm glad to hear that because I feel like I could always go further with it. But yes, I do try to kind of make you aware of the smell in the space and the light and the ambience around it. But it always could go further.
Yeah, and as you say, you just need to find like the right environments to do it, which is a challenge in Joburg often to find.
Yes and no. It's interesting to think of it as, you know, is the gallery the right space for it? Or is, like, for example, the dilapidated, abandoned mansion the right space for it? And I think both have very different ways of allowing that kind of work to exist. Yeah, and both are interesting in their own ways. But I definitely think you read it very differently when it's in a abandoned space or in a museum or art fair or gallery. I mean, I've had an installation at an art fair and it challenged a lot of people and I think that was a good thing, where they kind of questioned why would something like this be at an art fair where it's not necessarily consumable or you can't buy it. It's just purely experiential and ephemeral. So I think that was interesting for the curator to include that work in the context of an art fair. Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. So, I mean, I would describe your drawings and your tactile drawings as abstract, or it makes me think about kind of automatic drawing, you know, that what emerged in the surrealist movement, the subconscious drawing. What are your thoughts on that? Do you identify with that at all?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely embrace that in a certain way where, you know, I don't, like when I get into the zone of drawing, then it is very kind of automatic or intuitive, where I'm kind of working in a very intuitive way, but it's kind of founded on having done a lot of research around something that I want to communicate or like a certain place or a certain sense that I want to convey. So I do have an idea of what I want to, where I want to take the viewer, and then I kind of go into that space and start working with that, like working with the kind of language that I've developed, the kind of code that I've developed in the drawing. So yeah, I mean, yes and no. I say, like, there is an element of that in the drawing.
You frequently refer to the notion of the third landscape with regards to your work. Can you talk us through that notion?
So it's something, it's a term that a landscaper and gardener came up with, Charles Clement. He came up with this term of these spaces that are kind of the like leftover spaces within the city or urban landscape. These, either they a reserve on the outskirts of a city or in the city, and they're just left to kind of proliferate as nature would. And he argued that in these spaces, these are the kind of ecological and genetic reservoirs of ecology. Yeah, so I was very intrigued by that as a concept of thinking, or as like a lens to think about how things evolve, because I'm very interested in ecology and ecologies and urban ecologies. And I also think of the third landscape as they're a space for opportunism and chaos. Yeah, a space for adaptation and things festering. And I think that also then links to another idea that I'm interested in entropy, where that kind of is about disorder, or things kind of unfolding into disorder and unfolding into decay or chaos. So for me, those two concepts kind of speak to each other, where they coexist with each other as these disruptions that happen in this kind of order that we expect to create in our human habitats.
Your last two solo shows, the one was in, I think, 2017 and the other one in 2019, they both have the word entropy in them. I was wondering about how you associate that word with our current context and like what it means. Like, do you see what's happening in the world right now with COVID-19, like as an entropy, like as something that is being dismantled, that is decaying into chaos, or like, what are your thoughts on those theories that you are working with in your work and how it relates to what's happening now?
Yeah, I think it is quite interesting for me to think about what is happening with COVID-19 in relationship to those ideas, because I think it is precisely that. It's like, you know, pandemics are something that we're probably going to see more and more of as, you know, as the environment takes more strain. And it's something that we need to start leaning into more and more, where we need to become comfortable with that, and we need to become more adaptive and adaptable within those situations. Yeah, and so entropy has always been an important way for me. It's like a way of being, where you need to be able to create a kind of new order within the disorder, or like the way that I see it is that it's like a dance. You have to like adapt into all these different things happening all at once, and to become comfortable with unpredictability and uncertainty, if you know what I mean.
So are you saying entropy isn't necessarily like a negative state? It's a space of possibility. It's a space of transformation.
Yes. For me, it's definitely not negative. It's a natural state of being, and it is a thing that entropy is not a negative thing. It's something that it's a space for adapting, for adaptability, and to take the opportunity. It's an opportunistic space, because as things evolve or devolve, you need to be inventive in those spaces. And so, yeah, I mean, just you made reference of the my solo shows. So with my show last year, Life in the Entropics, that I kind of invented this space of the entropics as this new reality, or this new space, this new world, this like dystopian utopian space where, you know, it's like you need to be living with the trouble, so to speak.
How do you think we live differently now?
I don't think it's necessarily that we don't adapt, but I do think in the world of consumerism and capitalism, we are very comfortable with knowing what to expect, knowing a certain order, you know, and having a certain quality of life. And yeah, we're not in that space. We're not easily adaptive to chaos. And now we've been like flung into chaos, you know, and people have been scrambling for comfort and scrambling for some kind of structure and order. And I mean, there's value in that. I think it's not about discarding or discrediting the opposite. It's more like it's a binary. It's like you need to have one for the other, and it's like you need to balance. It's about balancing both these modes of being, of order and disorder. And
so, McCandle, what would you say would be your proudest moments in your art career in the last few years?
Yeah, some of my proudest moments have definitely been the residency that I went on in New York for 3 months. That was definitely a highlight for me. I think also just having a solo show has always been a highlight and a proud moment for me in my career thus far. I think shows and residencies are my, I mean, obviously, because that's where you get to show your work and have an audience converse with it and engage with it and resonate with it. And I think that's always a very exciting moment for an artist, is to kind of have this feedback on like, does it actually resonate, you know, and have a place and space in other people's minds and hearts and homes.
Yeah, always an important one for them to take it home. But yeah, I mean, when I look at, you know, how you've grown over the last few years, I'm really impressed with the shows that you've had in like very prestigious galleries, Kalashnikov Gallery, Everard Reed in Cape Town. You've been on most art fairs for the last few years. And one of my favorite, proudest moments of you is you were included in an article in Wallpaper Magazine, an international magazine, that listed, I think, 9 South African artists to like look out for or something like that. And you were amongst kind of very, very incredible, prestigious artists like Nicholas Klobo, Nandipa Mtambo, Lady Scully, and a few others. I can't remember offhand right now, but I was incredibly proud in that moment for you to be listed amongst that company. And for me, that was a proud moment for me, at least.
Thank you. Definitely. It was a huge compliment to be included in that. Thank you for mentioning that.
Which artists are you inspired by? I mean, who do you look at both historically and in this contemporary moment? Who are you looking at?
I look at a lot of people all the time, and also not necessarily artists, but I think some of the artists that I really draw inspiration from and enjoy kind of following their practices are Julie Moretu, Meg Webster, and I guess art historically side, Twombly is definitely an influence, and then also Sarah Tse.
I see a Kandinsky poster behind you.
Yes,
and
yes,
I'm definitely seeing some Kandinsky influence.
Yeah, Kandinsky and Miro are also definitely inspirations. And then Pierre Haig, which I always struggle with his surname. Those are some of the artists that I look at. Yeah, and that influenced my work. Oh, there is another one that I kind of follow obsessively on Instagram that I just think he's really brilliant. What is his name? Nicholas Lamas. Probably one of my top artists to look at. His work's really poignant.
And finally, what are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, I'm working on a series of drawings from my balcony, where I'm restricted. That's the view that I have. But I've got a very compelling view, as views go, where I've got this beautiful kind of green belt before the city skyline of Johannesburg. And it's very seductive. You know, it's the only piece of outside I have at the moment. So I've been very drawn to that kind of view. So I'm working on a series with that. And then otherwise, also, my compost heap is a piece of work that I'm working on.
Oh, yeah?
Where I'm kind of generating this soil. But that's for a project for another time, for another conversation.
Okay, cool. Well, thank you so much, Makhando.
Watch the space.
Yes, I can't wait to see what comes next post-lockdown and for the rest of the year. And thank you so much for your time. And it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Anthea. That was wonderful to speak with you. And I look forward to hearing about all the other artists that you interview. I'm excited to listen to Unframed podcast in the coming days.
Thank you so much to Makhando and to you, the listeners, for joining me today. Please follow Unframed Podcast on Facebook and Instagram and share this episode with your networks and encourage them to follow Unframed too. You can also subscribe on Apple Music and please rate and review us, as it will help us to get more followers. Thank you and see you next time. Bye.